Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello Slackers, I hope you're good. Welcome to this week's Slacker Podcast, the most splendiferous, magnificent moment in podcast history. Joe Rogan has said that this podcast was his biggest inspiration for him starting his podcast, even though this only came out 3 years ago and he started his about 20 years ago or whatever. But yeah, I'm not making this shit up. I'm really not, honestly. Hope you're good. I hope you're getting through the January lockdown vibes. Or for anybody who's binging this, lockdown 47 in 2023. As you can probably tell, I'm just enjoying being able to speak out loud. You kind of forget what your voice sounds like for a little bit with the isolation, just not talking to people as much, not seeing as many people, not being as social, which means you gotta rely on your favorite content, and the Slacker Podcast is always here for you guys. I've been listening to tons of stuff, the Tommy and Hector podcast, which I think is amazing, various different football podcasts, which I will not go on about at length because it doesn't sound right. And listen, if you want even more content, then I have a brand new show that's available only on Spotify right now. It is called Chill the Beats. It is 2 hours of the finest, most alternative music that you can find within the chill genre. It's deep cuts and classics. It's trailblazers of the future. It's weightless. It's floaty. It is essentially everything that you need to kind of defrazzle your brain and give yourself a wee bit of headspace. As I say on this show, it's a little bit of musical medicine for the soul. So you can check that out. It drops every Sunday on Spotify. I'm doing some daily meditations on that feed on Spotify as well. There's loads of content up there. And there's a Patreon for it that you can join as well. But go check it out. And if you like it, share it as with this as well. I mean, the Slacker Podcast is getting to stalwart territory now. It came up on my time hop, what is this like? It just came up on Instagram going, 3 years ago today, you were recording with Declan McKenna, which was like one of the first podcasts that I've done. So we're coming up to the 3 year anniversary. I think we started it in March 2018. So big up to yourselves for sticking with it. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing with podcasts. You just need to keep bringing them out all the time. Old Reliable, the Slacker Podcast, and Old Reliable, the Chill the Beat Show. So who have we got this week? This week it is a podcast that I recorded with garage legend, recording legend, piano tinkler, probably not what he would put on his press release, but a piano and musical genius that is MJ Cole. And we covered a lot of musical bases on this, and we covered a lot of musical bases that I really enjoy talking about that I don't get to talk to other guests about, which I thought was cool. And he's really open and honest about his career, the good times, the bad times, and all of the fun bits in between. So I think you're going to enjoy this. This is the Slacker Podcast with MJ Cole in 3, 2, Everybody, one. Today's Slacker Podcast is with MJ Cole. Hello.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Very good. Yeah, I mean, I could have said today's Slacker Podcast is with Matthew James Firth Coleman.
You could have indeed. That would have been equally correct.
Why did you drop the man from the coal?
Well, I was looking for a name. I reckon it was around 97, started making my own records, and I was just looking for an artist name, basically. And it's actually a garage DJ I was working with at the time, I think called Naughty Be Nice. He was on London Underground, and I was sort of about to release a record. He suggested it, actually, use MJ and then Cole. Just thought it sounded good, and I just thought, yeah, it sounds good, so I stuck with that.
Did you ever get pissed off when Maya Jane Cole's landed on the scene and then everybody started getting confused?
No, not with her. No, but obviously I get a few misdirected emails, and you know, I'll get a few YouTube comments where people are like, "This doesn't sound like her," blah blah blah, or "I came here to find Maya Jane Cole's. Why are you using her Twitter handle?" And you know, all this sort of rubbish you get. You know, I had it actually today on Twitter. Someone was, you know, thought I was J. Cole, the US rapper, and was like, not laying into me, but saying, like, "I wonder why, what MJ Cole thinks about what No Name has said about blah, blah, blah." It's quite funny. So I get a little waft of MJC's, you know, coming in, sort of misdirected things. It's fascinating.
I would imagine that, like, the others get it goes the other way. I mean, I wasn't able to get my Twitter handle Phil Taggart, our Instagram handle. So there's another Phil Taggart who gets tweeted things all the time, good and bad. Anytime I'm on radio, the poor fella's just getting berated. You are shite, or this is great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just sitting there just going, oh, okay.
Yeah, he probably loves it. And then you're missing out on the, well, I guess, I mean, I presume it's mostly adoration anyway, so you're missing out on a few big ups there. That's not fair, is it?
Yeah, exactly. He's sitting on his ass doing sweet fuck all, like, and there's me, like, trying my best.
Yeah, and he's been there wallowing, being showered in praise.
Yeah, fed grapes.
Yeah.
So we start every podcast with a demo, which we'll get to in a second, because I can see you're in a studio space in Shoreditch, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, I never left the studio. I mean, I do go home, but I've been lucky here in that the main complex was completely shut down, but I've got a key to the little door, and I've got a key to my door, and I can just run through without seeing anyone, basically. So it's been cool. I only live like 8 minute cycle away. So yeah, I've pretty much been here the whole time.
Have you been making music like throughout lockdown? Have you been on the keys, on the piano? Have you been making dark and disgusting club records?
I've been doing a combination of both, because I'm just thinking about where I'm going to go next. And so I've been doing a series of tracks in both those veins, like three or four tracks in both those veins, to try and decide, you know, if I want to do more of the kind of piano thing or do more of the dancing. I've come to the conclusion that I want to do both. So, and I don't see why I shouldn't be able to now. I've proven that I can do both. And so the selection of things I've made recently, one of them's sounds like it's a big brassy trombone stab, you know, dance thing with just a kick and a snare in it. And then I've been doing some other, you know, piano sketches and stuff as well. So it's been a combination, and I'm kind of into this, me being able to do what I want. And it's been great. If everyone said, you know, if everyone thought the Magic Order album was rubbish, then I'd probably just be scared off by that. But it's been received really well. So I feel like I can sort of branch out and hopefully, you know, do what I want to do. Basically,
I was gonna ask, like, is that, like, the Madrigada album's been out for a little while now, like, I mean, how has it been, like, how have you been, do you read the reviews, have people been saying nice things about it, have they been buying it?
Yeah, I think they have. I mean, obviously it's different from, you know, like a chart record banger song thing, in that, you know, you're not looking for, you know, like Radio 1 A-list, and you're not looking for like chart positions. It's much more of a long game, I think, with an album like that. But, you know, the personal messages I've had from some really great people in music that I really respect and very surprised to get a message from, that kind of praise has been really great.
Who's been reaching out?
Oh, I don't know. I had like a nice message from Mike Skinner. Goldie rang me up and said some really nice things. You know, Giles Peterson, like loads of different people basically that I haven't spoken to for a couple of months, couple of years, even some of them. And they got back and just, you know, said how much they love the record. So that's been really great. I don't really know in terms of numbers, but I know it was number one on the iTunes classical chart for a bit and stuff like that. So it's cool. It's been nice to be played on, you know, to play on your show, and like Annie's played Cathedral on her show. But then I've been played on Radio 3 as well, you know, by like Elizabeth Arden and people like that. So that's pretty cool to have the same record be played on 1 and 3 within the same week.
It's crazy. Like, it's not that crazy. I mean, like when you think about like where you came from in garage music, and because like there was always like a little element of some of the production of garage music which was a little bit classical. Like, you know, there'd always be like little violins in there somewhere. Do you know, like it's not like you're coming from, I don't know, like Minor Threat punk rock to classical. Like you definitely have always kind of showed that side of your skill set.
Yeah, it's always been there. If you listen to, you know, quite a few of the intros that I've had on tracks, and quite a few of the breakdowns, often the piano kind of comes out there. So yeah, it's always been a feature, and it's not like I've just suddenly done some kind of, you know, personality reform, transgression, I don't know what you call it, you know what I'm saying, schizophrenic switch. It's always been there as part of the fabric of my music, so it's just like come out and had its little foray, its little time in the spotlight for a bit.
So we always play a demo at the very beginning. The demo that we have of yours, I'm gonna blast in now in a second, is called, like, I'd assume this isn't the proper name for it. Most of the demos that we get sent in the Slacker podcast aren't the proper names for it, but it's Maldives, yeah. Beta 7_97.
Right. Yeah. So it's called Maldives, and so basically, I think I went for the first time I ever went on a nice holiday with a girlfriend to the Maldives. I'm just, you know, as I write things, I just call them the first thing that's in my mind. So it might be like, you know, I call something banana, or, you know, just whatever's lying around. I don't really put much effort into it. So yeah, it's called Maldives, and it was like one of the first tracks I think maybe I used, where I used these pizzicato strings from, that I became kind of known for, from a certain sound module, and it was just written as an instrumental. And when I came back from holiday, I don't know if I should, do you want me to reveal it all now or after everyone listens?
Oh God, I don't know. Let me think. Do you know what? Let's
it's going to become fairly obvious.
Let's play it in. Let's play it in first.
No, it's never been heard anywhere before. That was just sitting around on that tape, yeah.
Sweet. A Maldives MJ Cole demo exclusive for the Slacker podcast. So you were going to reveal something to us just before we got into it. What was it?
Yeah, so obviously this became Crazy Love. And this was the original instrumental demo that I cooked up before... the infamous Elizabeth Troy got her dulcet tones on it. So this would have been the state I played it to her to start with. And then she began to work her magic. And we did that in the studio in Torrington Place around there. That was back in those days. So yeah, it would have been sitting there on her DAT, and she came in. And I remember her saying about that track, she's like, oh, I've got something for this, Matt, but it's too simple. I think it's just too simple. And I was like, no, simple is good. And she repeats that story back to me even now. So she came up with the hook and just smashed it out. And then it turned out, came out pretty quickly, that. But I was amazed by how much was actually there from the original demo when I listened to the demo, because quite often it changes a lot. And I hadn't found that demo. I hadn't listened to that demo for, you know, 20 years, basically, and just found it. So I was quite surprised how much of the musical stuff was there, but there's changes that go on that you can tell have developed as the record went on. But yeah, it was quite it was an interesting find for me, that.
What stage of like your experience of production were you at when you made that?
So I would have been. I probably started working in studios in 95. But I'd been making records in my bedroom for 10 years before that, probably. So yeah, I was kind of, I kind of knew what I was up to. I was engineering for a lot of other people. I was doing big SSL sessions, like just engineering for other people, recording bands, that sort of thing. So I knew my way around the equipment, and I've been making music on, you know, software on computers for probably 10 years before that.
What does a bedroom producer look like before 1995? When you said you were making records there, like it's not exactly like just lifting up the laptop and clicking on the GarageBand like you can do now, is it?
Yeah.
Like, what sort of gear are you on?
That would have been an Atari ST computer, you know, originally made as a games computer, the same era as the Commodore Amiga, you know, which was like an evolution on from the, you know, the ZX Spectrum, those kind of things. So yeah, it was primarily a gaming computer, but it was a, you know, beige computer. It had a floppy disk drive in the side. It had MIDI in and MIDI out built in, which was great. You didn't have to have a box for it. And it had, you had to have the Atari monitor that came with it, which is this, you know, about this big with a huge bum on it and stuff. So it was that, and then a sampler. I think that would have been done on one of the Akai samplers, probably an S1000 or a Roland S760, something like that. And then the strings come from a sound module, Yamaha TG500. So it's basically an Atari, a sampler, and a couple of sound modules.
Yeah, there we go. Do you reckon some of the romance has gone out of it a little bit now that you can get every single sound effect you want at the click of a button?
No, not for me at all, because I'm still a sound hunter, and I still like sampling things, not necessarily from existing records. I go to, you know, sample packs, Splice, places like that, Loopmasters, and just sift through, and that's amazing. I can sift through that like a record collection. But I still enjoy finding tiny bits of sounds and manipulating them, turning them upside down, pitching them up, pitching them down, getting them spread across my keyboard and creating things like that. So no, I don't think I've lost any of that kind of the romance involved with, you know, seeking out sounds and stuff.
What is the oddest thing that you've sampled for a track or put on a track?
I've had lots of things. I used to carry a field recorder with me, and I guess now it's like an iPhone with the voice memos. So I've had drums off, you know, you turn a voice memo on and you just put your iPhone down on the flat surface and it goes because it's just sort of finding its balance in a case. So I've had some really good drum stuff off that. I quite often weave in a bit of environmental things, like my, you know, my kids saying things or messed around, or one of my kids playing the piano. And I've had stuff in, in fact, a tune that I've been doing this week that I've kind of resurrected from a few years ago had a sampler instrument called Chop Me Pret. And I think I was in Pret one day and there was something on the speakers and I've just stuck my voice memo thing on. And then chopped up all the bits, and you can't really hear the music. You can hear more of the environmental stuff. But that was I have a sample instrument called Chop Me Pret,
and that sounds great. You said that your kid plays the piano. Are you like, as someone whose dad tried to teach him to play the piano, I it didn't work out very well because I just like it's hard when your parents try and teach you something. Like, do you teach your kid to play?
No, my eldest daughter, she does have lessons at school, but she doesn't go to school anymore, so that's sort of dried up. It's something I'm very aware of. I'm aware of overdoing it, because obviously I could try and teach her. I don't think that would be the way to go. I think I probably want to go the way that I went, where I had an external teacher outside school that was nothing to do with school. And that's the way I went on. I think it's like your dad trying to teach you to drive, isn't it? Or your mum trying to teach you to drive. It usually goes pear-shaped.
So
it's not the ideal thing. I'm there to give advice and sort of point her in the right direction and stuff. But I think teachers are very underrated people, and they have a special knack for actually being able to teach people. And it's not as easy as it may seem.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's a whole level of being able to connect with somebody and get the engagement. I think engagement's the most important thing for if you're going to teach anybody anything. And if your parent, who's like telling you to do 100 different things a day, is telling you to do this you're not going to listen, yeah. are you? It's all about the engagement.
No. Yeah, I don't know anyone who's been successively taught by their parents.
Do you know who I had on the podcast last season? Ludovico Einaudi, the piano composer. And
yeah,
he was talking about he was talking about how his mum was a piano player and his family, and I was like, were you taught by them? He was like, no, like I would never get taught by somebody in the family. And I'm just trying to think through my family and stuff, and I'm like, no, it doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, I know a lot of good players who have very famous parents, like Sir Clive Davis. His son went to my school and he was an amazing violinist, but I don't think he was taught by his dad either. So yeah, it's the way it's done. I think it's you have to outsource that. It's just too much overlap.
When you got into like playing piano and the oboe and stuff like that, what age were you sent? Were you sent when you were like a kid? Like, were you very young when you started?
Yeah, piano started at 5, and then I would have been playing recorder at school, just as you do. And then so I probably started playing oboe when I was about, I don't know, 8 or something like that. And then I started going to Royal College of Music when I was 11 every Saturday in addition to normal school.
Oh my God.
And that's when it really sort of kicked off. Although I'd say between like 7 and 11, I made the biggest advances in playing those instruments when I was at primary school.
Did you enjoy it? Like, was it something that just seemed like it was normal to do, or like, did you want to get better at it, or what sort of relationship with you did you have?
Yeah, I mean, the scene was that I did my first competition at that Hounslow Music Festival when I was 5. And it was a set piece where there's like 32 kids all come up to the stage one by one and all play the same piece. And I remember it was called In the Meadows. And so I played in this competition. My piano teacher just sort of said, go and do this competition. But I won out of 32 kids. Most of them were girls. And for me, as a little 5-year-old boy, I was kind of like, yeah, this is cool. I'm into it. And that's really what got me going. And then I found I had like an aptitude for it. And my mates would come round, we'd be skateboarding up and down the street and roller skating as you did like in the late 70s or whatever. And I remember one day playing for them, just sitting down at the piano, just like playing this thing. They're like, how can you play the piano? Like, and I sort of realized then that I was sort of onto something and I had a special little sort of niche. And I did really well at the competitions and stuff. So that kind of spurred me on. But I think I developed my sort of relationship with music, like music became my expression at a very early age, and I think that's really stayed with me throughout my life.
I mean, a lot of people would start in bands because they want to attract the fairer sex, or they want to show off, or they want like various different reasons to do it. I mean, there's no better way of encouragement than winning a competition. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it didn't really cross my mind at that time, but yeah, maybe I could have done better in those years if I'd have realised that.
Were you somewhat of a child prodigy around your bits then? Were you like known as the piano boy, like the piano kid?
Yeah, I wouldn't call myself a prodigy. There were definitely people around me who were playing in competitions that were just... I think a prodigy is something very, very few and far between and very unique. I think, you know, the way I kind of feel, there might be 5 to 10 musical prodigies in the country every year, something like that. It's a really, really small amount. So I wouldn't put myself in that category, but I say I was a good 8.5 out of 10.
Were you one of those people that could pick up any instrument? Because like they always say that if you can play the piano, you can play anything.
No, I think there's technique involved in any of it. So, you know, piano and over my thing. I've always wanted to play guitar, but I think just the idea of picking up an instrument, obviously I can pick any instrument. I'm reasonably strong. But to actually, you know, get into it, get the technique going requires a bit of nous. And so I'd like to think I could learn any other one. I'd like to play bass guitar or guitar. but I never really get around to it.
I'll teach you how to play bass. I played for 10 years, like in a band. So I'll give you some slap bass lessons. How about that? I'll slap the mic.
Yeah, man, let's do it. I don't want to do fretless, like 80s style. And then maybe I'll translate my oboe technique to sax, and then we can bring back the sax solo as well.
That's big. That's big. You be Clarence Clements, and I'll do the level 42 shit. How about that?
Yeah, I'm totally down with that. I used to listen to a lot of Level 42 when I was, younger.
It's all about Thundercat now, man, when it comes to playing the bass. It's all about Thundercat.
Yeah, he's a very sick puppy.
He very much so. Also, I heard an interview with him recently, and from his lyrics, he always comes across as somebody who's like a massive laugh and like a bit irreverent and into comic books. And I heard an interview with him, and he was so morose and so depressed and stuff. And I was like, this like doesn't match up with the songs that I'm hearing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, maybe he spent all his emotion and he's completely depleted. Yeah, and that's how you found him, you know.
I actually had to Google oboe. I know oboe is one of those instruments that you know it exists and you've heard the name of it loads of times. But like, if you actually asked me to draw it off the top of my head, I'd be like, oh, crap, is it one of the ones that you blow into? Is it like a, I thought it was some sort of saxophone or something.
I can tell you about it if you want.
Yeah, well, how did you get into like playing that? The piano I get, but the oboe I get less.
Yeah, I think it's because my cousin, who's 2 years older than me, he played the oboe, and so I just thought I'd have a go at that. And yeah, so the oboe is a bit of a strange instrument. It's the instrument they use to tune the orchestra. So the oboe plays an A, and the whole orchestra always tunes to that. But people would know it most from the theme from Emmerdale Farm. You know, that was oboe. Yeah. And it's a double reed instrument, which basically means it's very hard to play. Like clarinet and saxophone, they're single reed. There's a bit of plastical wood and the reed sits against that, but with oboe it's actually two bits of reed that go in your gob. So the reeds are a nightmare. They wear out, they split, you have to bind them together. It's difficult reed wise if you're an oboist.
And did you keep it up? Did you play in orchestras and stuff like that?
Yeah, all the way through school I was playing in orchestras at Royal College of Music. I was playing in orchestras and ensembles and, you know, quartets, quintets, things like that, up until I was about 18. And I probably, I carried on till up to about 17. And I haven't played it since, but I still have my oboe. And in fact, I got it out the other day with my daughters. We found it in the cupboard somewhere. And I started to play it, and they found that very funny.
I'm sure they did. But it was getting into dance music then a bit of a reaction to the classical sort of upbringing that you had?
Yeah, I guess it was, you know, kind of late 80s, early 90s was just such an amazing time to be alive musically, because it was just all emerging. You know, in 88, I was 15. So I was just starting to go out to clubs and stuff in 1988, which is now seen as like, a seminal year in dance music. So it was exciting for me. It was no one really knew what it was. It was all sort of coming in through pirate radio. There'd be a few record shops to go to. It was like the equivalent of my punk, I guess. It's sort of the music that your mum and dad know nothing about, that sounds really loud. You sit there in your bedroom with your decks, like caning it, getting asked to turn it down. So it was like my rebellious kind of music. But then I became fascinated with, making it and the construction of it. And then obviously I was going out to all these kind of early raves and stuff and having the time of my life.
Was it, what year was it? Was the second Summer of Love? Was that 88 or was that like 90? It was around that era.
I don't know. I think it was, I don't know. Isn't Summer of Love, isn't that originally a 1960s American sort of thing?
Yeah, but they say the second Summer of Love was like in England, I think around the 1990s, basically when the whole country was flooded with ecstasy, I would hazard a guess at. But like when you were 15 and going out and going to, which was really like the genesis of good dance culture in the UK, like what was it like? Like what sort of music were they playing when you were first?
Oh man, it was amazing because it was such a mashup. There was no genre definitions. It wasn't, you know, there was no like, oh, this is house, this is drum and bass, da, 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 da. You know, you go and see people playing and they'd be playing some records that had a kick drum in, but that was still 150 BPM. Other records that had break beats in, other ones that were more kind of tech sounding that came from drum machines. And then there'd be like bits of vocals in there. There'd be like hip hop, hip house going on. It was a complete mashup, you know, house music, skippy stuff, non-skippy stuff, bassy things. And no one really knew what it was, but no one cared because as a whole, it was just this new world. It was just amazing. And it was, you know, every time you went out, there was something new and there were tapes of all these sets. And we were all just bedroom DJing, like recording tapes every day, swapping them with our mates. We had Walkmans on the tube, going to school. You know, it was a cool time. It was really exciting and really fast moving and really new.
Who were the DJs and what were the clubs that you needed to go to at that stage?
I used to go to places like Fun City was always a big one for me, and that was mostly at Busby's that was in Charing Cross Road, that where the Astoria used to be. And you know, there'd be DJs like Ray Keith used to DJ a lot, who's still like making sick stuff now, and he's still around. Ray Keith, you know, Nicky Black Market, and then there were people like Tintin, you know, Doc Scott was playing, Randall was around then, and Fabio. Who was it? Was it Mickey Slim? I can't remember. No, loads of guys like that. I was just following them around.
Were those DJs big because of their sets, or were they big because of pirate radio, or was it a bit of a mixture of both?
For me, they were big because of their sets, and their sets were big because of selection and also technique as well.
Yeah,
you know, I had a very soft spot for like Randall. He used to play always the last set at a place called Innocence that was at Laserdrome in Peckham. This would have been early 90s. He always used to play like 5 to 6 because I guess he'd been elsewhere.
That's a really intense time. Like, who the fuck remembers? Who remembers any record that is played between 5 and 6? Who remembers any record that is played between 1 and 6?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I had like, there was a mate of mine, Joe Lawrence, who was under the DJ name Nutty One back in those days. And he worked at, I think it was Great Asset, the record distribution thing. And he was one of my mates. So he'd basically know what the records were that all these guys were playing. And he used to like every month bring me a bag of new stuff.
No.
And I'd just be there, you know, at 5 in the morning, just be like, Joe, what's this? Joe, what's that? He's like, yeah, we got that in. I'll put it in your bag. So all it really took was a little nudge on Joe.
Yeah.
And then it would appear in a bag. And then I'd listen to it at home. Obviously, it would sound nothing like how I remembered it, because you listen to it in a massive club through a huge system. And then you suddenly go home. And there's like no reverb or anything. It's like, is that the same record? But yeah, it usually was. So yeah, there were ways of recognizing these.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Things.
Have you taken on a lot of stuff that you saw in those early sets into how you perform live? Like, can you see parallels to, cause, or can you see parallels to what DJing's like now to then? Like, I mean, essentially, to the layman, it's just playing two records together and making sure that they fit well within a themed set that has a little bit of a journey. But like, has it changed much over the years?
Well, I mean, I think definitely DJ wise, what I took from the early days was, it, you know, especially in the sort of jungle drum and bass thing that I was into, I was always in the jungle drum and bass room, not the house garage room. But the DJ technique then was very, it was quite chubby. There was a lot of crossfader action going on. You'd have like one track going, you know, beat match on the right, and you just slip in a snare, or, you know, there'd be a lot of crossfader action going on. And I think I used that a lot in my DJ sets. You know, I always like using the crossfader as opposed to going up and down with the faders, which I guess is more of like a house thing. So yeah, I definitely took that, and, you know, the rewind and the deck stops and the, you know, turning the power off, so you go stuff like that. How, so yeah, I you know,
how come you were in the you were in the drum and bass and jungle room and not in the garage and house room when you have such a massive place in garage's history? Like,
because I didn't like house or garage music at all.
That sounds like Cristiano Ronaldo playing in defense. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. I mean, I had no interest in house or garage or anything around 120 BPM. I was like 150 plus and breakbeats only. And I had no interest in whatsoever. The only reason I started making garage music was because I was working in the studio and as an engineer day by day. And I had a load of garage DJs come in, and they wanted to make garage records, and I was on the button, so I had to sort of learn how to put it together. But I think that's part of the reason that my garage records were slightly different, is that really I had no idea what I was doing. And so it's just my way of putting them together, because I had no ideas what records were called or how it should be or how an arrangement should be. I just had some guys there who were feeding me like records and saying no, it should be like this, don't worry, diddle-a-lo. And so following their lead, so that's really how the garage thing started for me.
Do you think that's weird? Like, do you hear garage tracks, like if you hear garage tracks over the years that sound like carbon copies of yours, and then like that's funny because you just were kind of making it up as you went along almost?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't trying to be like anything, and I just following my nose really and following my vibe. So yeah, it's always weird when someone tries to make a record very like yours, because I've tried to make records like other people's, and it's very unrewarding.
Yeah,
you know, it's never as good as the one you're trying to sort of copy or rip off. Yeah, if it goes off on a different tangent and you get a starting point for something, that can often be quite good. And then you go back to where it started, and it bears no relation to it whatsoever. But it's all about getting that initial spark, that initial cell to get you going.
I've probably said this at some point on the podcast before, but I've heard, like, I remember hearing somebody say that the best artists are the ones that are bad at ripping off the artists that they want to. That's where the originality comes from. Like,
yeah,
you sit down to go, I want to write a song that's like Green Day, and it ends up sounding like fucking I don't know, like ABBA. But like,
yeah,
apart from that, that's the, like, that's where the best artists come from. Who was it said that? I can't remember.
Well, for me, I think most of it started, it was US, and you know, I think it was US B-sides, dub mixes of you know, more kind of US garage tracks basically, but sped up. A lot of people talk about Gas Club on, I think it was a Sunday night in Covent Garden, and there were DJs playing there like like Hermit and Jason K, people like that. I think even Mikey B from Dream Team, those kind of guys, they were just playing B-sides, dub mixes of US, more, you know, kind of vocal, soulful garage tracks. They were just playing the dubs at +8, basically, and just mixing them together. So for me, that's kind of like where it came, because I learned from these guys who were DJing at all these clubs at the beginning. You know, I really, they were my source of inspiration at the beginning. I knew nothing about it. So it was literally like, I'm in the studio, guy comes in, big box of records, there's a record deck there, start playing stuff and be like, yeah, cool, right, okay, we can get the hi-hat from there, or like, hear the way this happened, just learning on the spot.
What were the records that, like, you think are important? Like, if you look back at, like, the first sort of garage records that you took influence from?
So I think some of the, you know, Todd Edwards was making stuff back then. I mean, he must have been about 16 or something. I thought he must have been about, you know, 30 by the sort of maturity of his music. But I was listening to things by him. I think Roy Davis Jr. Gabrielle is probably one of the first garage records, even though it wasn't supposed to be a garage record. It's just a record. And then I remember the beginnings of Two Step for me were really like, I think the Dream Team did a track called The Theme that was probably Gavin Mills and Brian, so DJ Face, they were behind the buttons on that one. And I remember actually having that record in Ramsey and Fenn's studio up in Tottenham and having it without the power on and just listening to the beat like, And that's where I started making my beats slowly and speeding them up so I could sort of analyze exactly what it was. But that, for me, it became very interesting when that whole not fall to the floor thing happened. And suddenly there was this whole, there was no framework really. The kick could be anywhere and it was all skipped. And that's what really got me going.
You can definitely tell that you've got like a massive passion for breaks and stuff with the early beats that you were making.
Yeah, I mean, I was I was obviously trying to make jungle stuff when I was younger, and I was pretty rubbish at it. And I've always found actual using breakbeats as sort of looping samples to be incredibly irritating, because I'm quite a sort of accurate person, as you probably tell from my music, and they were never quite in. And so pretty much all the beats that I made garage wise, they were always individually programmed. And I used to, at the end of a few tracks, I actually slowed the tempo down to prove that the drums that I programmed were one shots and individually done, because you can't really slow a breakbeat. Well, you couldn't in those days anyway. So quite a few tunes, and they slow down at the end. And in fact, some of those tunes have caught me out when I've been playing as well. I'm playing my own record. I've been showing off in the studio by slowing it down. I'm mixing in another track and I just get killed by my own beat slow down and suddenly it all falls apart. I got stung in the tail by my own cockiness.
That's where you need the sync button.
Yeah, well, they didn't have a sync button in the late 90s.
So what was the big, like your big moment, like the bit where your music career really kicked off?
It would have been making the single Sincere, and I made that in my bedroom. And
what a tune that is, dude.
Oh, thanks, dude. Yeah, suddenly a lot of stuff started happening with that record, and I had no idea what it was. I think so. Pete Tong had it as essential tune for 2 or 3 weeks running. I didn't really, like, with all greatest respect, I didn't even know what that show was or anything. I was just sort of listening to drum and bass, and, you know, in my bedroom. And then from that got picked up. Giles Peterson got interested. Arthur from Metrix, vinyl distribution in Reading, got interested. And that went from there. Then I got an album deal. And then it all kind of went mad around 2000 when that came out.
Yeah, it kind of did go a little bit mad. Like, I mean, you didn't set out to be a pop star, did you? Like,
no.
But you definitely ended up in 2000, you were.
Yeah, I wanted to be a studio bod. You know, I wanted to be a musician who starts off as an engineer and goes on to be a record producer. That's what I wanted to do. So it all kind of happened, but it was a joyous path to lead.
Like what goes through your head when Sincere does as well as it did? Like how do you not get carried away with it, or did you?
No, I didn't get carried away with it, because my buzz was always from making records. My buzz was always like the studio and being in there. And I think the biggest thrill that I ever had, or have and still have even to this day, is making something in the studio, going home and listening to it and loving it for 24 hours. That's like my favorite thing to do in the whole world. So that way exceeds any sort of extrinsic adulation that you might get. So it's all about like making the record. But of course, it's great to go out to a club or something and hear your record play, or you walk into a shop and you can hear your record play. But that was never my raison d'etre. That was never my aim. I didn't grow up wanting to be a pop star and think what shirt I was going to wear and, you know, that kind of stuff. Not interested, really.
But when Sincere did as well as it did, like, the pressure was on for you to get an album out and get more music out as quickly as possible. What was that like? Was that a fun experience, sort of getting that out? Like, or were you just more intrigued by singles? Like, had you even thought about making records at that point?
Yeah, I always wanted to be. I wanted to be signed to a major and to have an album out. I remember thinking that, and so making that first album was great. You know, I moved into a different studio. I had more toys to play with. You know, I was able to kind of access different singers, and I got very close with Elizabeth Troy, and we did loads of work together. And my manager at the time had loads of really great hookups with like brass players, and I'd mates from college who'd suddenly come in and do strings and stuff like that. So, no, it was a great experience. I totally loved it.
Well, you obviously nailed it as well, because the record got nominated for a Mercury in 2000.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
Who won the Mercury that year?
Badly Drawn Boy.
You must be gutted.
It was funny, you know, because I was sitting there at the Mercury's, and no one actually knew. I don't know if they do these days, but back then no one knew who the winner would be. Like, literally no one knew. And I guess except for the cameraman, who's got to focus in on who wins because they want to get their reaction. And so I was kind of sitting here on the table, and Badly Drawn Boy was sitting there on the table, and the camera was like pointing at both of us. So remember thinking like, oh, it's either going to be me or him, you know. It was pretty mad. And then it's like Badly Drawn Boy, and, hey. But that was cool. I did a full live performance there, like full band. It was great.
Who are like the god tier MCs when it comes to garage music? Because I feel like a lot of them would have been around that time. Like, for me, I couldn't have a conversation with anybody about garage without having Miss Dynamite, like, way up near the top, like.
Yeah. I mean, she's just totally unique, you know, as well as being not just, if you're talking apart from like hosts, you know, this wise, I don't think there's anyone who really matched her at all. And she's, you know, she's still around. She's still making sick records now.
Who else would be on there? What are you like? What
you're talking about, like recording MCs or just
recorded
hosting MCs?
Recorded
as well.
MCs, because like, I mean, I was about 12 or 13 when that was happening, and I wasn't in London or at any of the live gigs,
so
I don't know who the Toasted MCs are at all. But like the sort of recording artists, like, I mean, like, where do you stand with like Craig David?
Yeah, Craig David, amazing. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think of him as just an MC. I think of him as a singer. But yeah, I guess you're right. You know, he's a very talented man, and yeah, he made some great records. But I mean, you know, I was, when you said MCs, I'm just thinking like, you know, sort of, you know, Creed and, you know, MCDT and like all these kind of guys that made records as well. And yeah, I think Dynamite's a good pick, because I was never really like super MC. I mean, on my record, I had Fallacy, like Danny Vicious Fallacy. He was amazing. I worked with Rodney P and then Roots Maneuver as well. But they were like, they were UK hip hop dons, yeah, basically. Yeah. And I kind of nicked them for a bit of garage.
but like, yeah, I mean, you've got any genre that gets successful, people try and commercialize it as much as they possibly can, and which effectively ends up killing the genre. Like it happens with anything, any underground that goes overground, it ends up getting killed by, yeah, the majors. Who put the death nail, yeah, in garage, like the first time round? Like I can remember like artists, I can remember stuff like was it like Mystique and like real big super pop acts. I'm not saying they killed it, but I'm just saying that like it diluted it to this such a form that it wasn't interested in it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it was a combination of things. As the MC stuff started to come through, there was, you know, physical things going on, like there was violence starting to happen in clubs and the police were shutting it down and people were getting shot, and it all started to get a little bit, you know, murky basically. And then you know, and as these things happen, it was the same with, you know, dubstep, the same with drum and bass. You know, you have like a musical phase and then it goes all dark and kind of bassy and minimal, and then the musical stage might come up again. So I think around 2000 there was quite a musical stage, and then it went a bit deeper and it went much more MC led, and I think it started to get a bit more moody in the clubs, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. But from that, I think grime
was
probably
born,
came.
Yeah, it was kind
you
of
know,
like
that was esky. That was the beginning of grime, and also it was the beginning of dubstep, which also suffered a similar fate, you know, over the course of time.
Very much so. I mean, yeah, like the Americans never took the garage the same way that they took the dubstep, but like what the Americans called dubstep and what the UK called dubstep are two very, very different things. But like what must have been crazy hearing those early grime records, because like from my knowledge, it was kind of Wiley and the ASCII beat stuff that was the kind of beginning of it.
I'm not the right person to ask about that because I wasn't buying those records, really. Mm. I was still on the playing some nice chords and things like that. You'd have to ask Wiley.
Yeah.
He knows.
He knows who started it all off. So, like, obviously, you, at that stage, you were pretty much everywhere, but you were also producing other people, which must be really exciting because you said yourself you wanted to be a record producer. What was it like working with like Dizzy and KDB and Example and those sort of people?
Yeah, I mean, that all came quite a lot later. That's probably we're talking about like in the last 10 years. I think around the time of Sincere and things like that, I think I had the opportunity to produce for other people, but I don't think I really had the right toolbox for that because I'd just come from my bedroom really.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have the full skills to be able to appreciate who an artist is and produce from their point of view, like to try and make the best record you can for that artist. So in a way you're working to boost them. I was just used to making records the best I could. So I think I was a bit too young to do stuff. And then as I've got older through my career, I think I'm much better at producing with and for other people now. So yeah, the Dizzy track that I did, Bassline Junkie, we did together.
I love, you know, that song. That song is fucking,
oh, cool.
It's,
yeah,
it's so ridiculously hard. Because like, yeah, I think that was the first, like, I think that was a return of Dizzy. I think Dizzy had been away for a little bit, and that was maybe his first record back after a while. Because I remember listening to like Zane Lowe on Radio 1 at that stage. And I just remember like going, hold on, is he saying, what was it like? What was the lyrics in it? There were some really fucked up lyrics in it. And I just remember going, you can't say that in a radio.
Big, dirty, stinking bass. I don't need no weed. I don't need no heroin. I don't need no coke. I don't need no ketamine. I'm a bass junkie. I'm gonna make it funky. Like that.
Yeah. I love that. Very briefly, but for a period of 2 weeks, got managed by Dizzy's manager, a guy called Nick Denton. And I remember going into the studio, and when you grow up with someone like Dizzy Rascal's, like almost like perfect for my age, like, because I would have been about maybe 13 or 14 when he started kicking off, perfect. Dizzy Rascal is the perfect sort of music if you're really like an angry young boy, like I just remember walking into his studio and he was just like lying there asleep on the sofa, and I was just like, whoa, that's Dizzy Rascal. Do you ever have that moment? Have you ever had that moment where you've walked in somewhere and you're like, whoa, that's X, Y, or Z?
I don't really get this much. I don't get this, not because I'm some conceited person who thinks they're great, but I don't really get that. I mean, I'm trying to think now. I mean, I've worked with some pretty top people, and I have sort of shat my pants a bit when I've worked with them, but I never get sort of starstruck by them. So who have I seen lying on a sofa or something like that? I'm trying to think now. I don't know. I can't really answer that one. I did a remix for Mariah Carey, and they flew me out to LA to do it. It was a bit of a mad one because they were so para of letting the DAT. So they wouldn't send the DAT tape over with the parts on because I think they'd been pirated or had something leaked before. Right, yeah. They were ultra paranoid. So instead of just sending me a tape, they flew me to LA, put me up in a hotel, put me in a massive studio. I get to the studio in LA and I haven't even heard the song. And then I got to meet Mariah, actually. She was finishing her album next door. So that was pretty crazy to go and meet like Mariah Carey and, you know, meet her in a little green room somewhere.
Is she really connected to her music in that, like, she, you know, she's the boss, or does she let other people do it? Because, like, you never know with an artist like that. She could be the queen bee, or she could be just turning up to the studio and just recording her bit and that's it.
Yeah, I couldn't answer that fully because, but the impression I get, and having spoken to a couple of, like, you know, engineers that work with her, she'd only use this one guy to record her voice, one engineer. She didn't trust anyone else. And she was very particular about her vocal performance and her vocal acrobatics and stuff like that. So, no, I think she was very... very involved in the content of her music. I don't think she just turned up, you know, and took a ticket and did it. Ask the MNEK, he's the expert on Mariah.
Is he? Like, are they like Bessie's?
Yeah, yeah, ask him. Sorry?
MNEK is a strange predicament because he always looked like he was going to be like the next Adele, the next like Sam Smith, the next like big, ridiculously huge UK singer. And then he just kind of was like, do you know what? I'm just going to write for other people. And he's written so many fucking bangers and so many like number one records.
That guy is like probably the most talented musician I know. I mean, he, like, his writing skills are like amazing. And it's not just like he sits at the back on the sofa. He produces whole records, like, and mixes them, plays everything on them, sings all the BVs. He's got like that sort of prodigy feel about him. To me, it's kind of like he doesn't even realize it, but to be able to be good in all those areas, like, you know, writing lyrics, actual vocal performance, you know, harmonies, chords, drum programming, production, like all in one, is very rare. And he's amazing, man. I mean, I've worked with him quite a few times, and he's a god.
I get a lot of that sort of energy from Charlie XCX as well. I feel like she's kind of like got that same sort of she can write the theme tune, sing the theme tune, make the artwork and do the whole thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? She's just
I've never met her, but I feel that. I mean, obviously you can see from their output and it's so diverse and they get involved in so many things. It's like, oh fuck, they're singing as well. It's like, wow. You know, so yeah, I'd love to work with her, actually. Can you make it happen, Phil?
Yeah, I'll make it happen. I'll stick the old like bat signal up into the air.
Okay, wicked. Yeah.
Are you like, do you work with people in like lots of different musical realms with what you do in production in 2020?
How do you mean?
As in like do you make like house records? Do you make pop records? When you're working with other people, do people come to you for specific sounds?
I mean, more often than not, I'll end up doing a session with, I guess the whole thing about songwriting and doing sessions is you don't want to be too prescriptive. If you're too prescriptive, you're going to squeeze the vibe out. So you need to like allow a certain amount of air, a certain amount of possibility for things to happen. So, you know, if I'm doing a writing session with someone and it's kind of like I'm an artist and they're an artist and we're just doing something together, then we'll just try and see whatever fits. But there might be other artists that come in who are in the middle of an album project and you can kind of see which way it's going. So I'm not going to suddenly start knocking out a garage beat. I might just swing over to the piano and it might be like we start with a piano thing. So, it really varies. And sometimes I might, as an artist, have a record and be looking for a top line and a vocal on it, and I'll have quite a specific idea about that, you know, what that would be. So it's a balance. You don't want to be too prescriptive, but you don't want to be too like, hey man, let's just do a session. Yeah, let's just see what happens. It's good to have some sort of idea.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, when you go in with no frame of reference, and I've done this on various different creative projects, if both people don't go in with anything, nothing's coming out. Like, at least somebody needs to lead a little bit. With JK and AJ Tracy having such big success with like Garage Records recently, with neither of them really particularly being just Garage MCs, like it's clear that that sound is very, very back in vogue in 2020. Do you have a hard drive somewhere that's full of bangers that's probably worth hundreds of thousands of pounds now if it got into the right hands?
Yeah.
When's it coming out? Like, sure.
Do I have
it feels like a good
time. I do have a lot of music sitting around. I forget about most of it, you know, unless I actually play through it. But because, you know, I didn't make records with JK. I've been close a couple of times. But with AJ, when I wrote The Rumble with him, that was a few years ago, which is kind of like not a garage record. It's a sort of bass heavy, rumbly thing. Still really proud of that record, actually. When he came to the studio, I'm like, this guy's a grime MC. I'm not making a garage beat with him. He's going to think that's soft, you know? So I'm like, I need hard beats. And that's how that record came out. But, you know, so it was kind of surprising, really, when he did the thing with Conductor or whatever, but which is an amazing record. But I always thought that people like that wouldn't be interested in garage, because garage sort of died this horrible death overnight. And I, you know, spent years trying to disassociate myself from it, really. I kind of went off to, I thought, oh, I've got to start a band. I started a band project with someone. I started like a down tempo thing. I started a house pseudonym to make house music. So it's taken me a long time to actually feel like, oh yeah, I can make a garage record with someone and they won't think like it's shit, basically. So it's interesting. I got properly scarred from the end of garage.
Yeah, I mean, it would do that to you, like, because like the music industry is a very fickle business. I mean, like one minute it's all punk and like punk music, and then the next minute it's glam. Do you know what I mean? People change their trainers and their jeans, and then that's it off.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
No, I mean, and now I've been, you know, I've been around for a while, and I've experienced the various undulations. So I've developed some pretty hefty suspension with long travel to deal with these bumps.
Well, and it leads us to Madrugada, like the record that you've just put out this year, and like it's definitely the biggest musical pendulum swing for not you, obviously, because you've been playing this classical music and stuff and piano like your whole life, but for me, as like as a fan of your music, I was just like, going, whoop, there we go.
Do you know? Right. Yeah.
When I'm used to, because like I remember, I was playing Boulders a lot. Like that summer it came out, I was playing that a lot, And if you like had it told mm-hmm. me that the Madrugada album came from the same person, it would be like, what? No. Do you know?
Yeah, no, that they were both me. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, for me, you know, whatever comes out is definitely from me. So it doesn't seem strange at all. But I can see from, you know, the outside that it might have been a surprise. I was scared, like I said before, I was worried that people would just be like, what is this? You know, Matt's just gone off on this different direction. We've lost him. But I think people sort of understand that I've always wanted to make a record like this, and I will in the future be able to make records like that. But equally, I'm equally interested in making bangers. And, you know, I made the record with Jimmy and Stormzy, Crown, last year, for example, that's, I guess, a pop record or whatever. But, you know, I just like to feel that I'm equipped to make all these things. And, you know, I don't really care about what genre people put me in. I'm very proud of being part of the beginning of UK garage, though. I think it's been cemented like into musical history now, and I think it's kind of the clay pot has gone into the kiln, it's been fired, and now it's there on the mantelpiece along with the other bastions of the you know, our musical heritage. So I'm kind of like, I'm proud that it wasn't just a flash in the pan, and it still is recognized as something. And I still think there's a lot of, as a genre, especially the two-step thing, as in not a 4-4 beat, I believe that is unfathomably, you know, it has such amazing potential to fit into any particular sort of music. You know, I'll always be happy to push that forward, and I feel like there's room still to push that forward.
I could see. Well, I mean, it feels like if anybody is going to bring two-step into modern music in 2020, I feel like it could be you. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, yeah, we have to do da, da, da. We have to wait and see. Let me get busy.
Listen, man, thank you so much for inviting me virtually into your studio in Shoreditch.
Pleasure, man.
It's been real fun. If anybody's listening to this, Madrugada, the album is out right now, and it's do you know what, it's a proper tonic as well for like 2020, because it's nice and relaxing, and you know, it puts me at ease a little bit, like listening to the keys and so the piano and stuff on it. So
so it's like from ease to ease,
from ease to ease. The MJ Cole story.
That's a good album title, isn't
it? Yeah, just call it.
Should have called it that.
Easy listening.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's been done.
Yeah, thanks so much for spinning it on your show and stuff, man. I really appreciate it. Yeah,
no probs, man. And I don't have a show unless I got good music to play on it.
There you go.
Wicked, man. Well, thanks for coming on Slacker Podcast. Thanks for sharing Maldives Beta 5_7 or whatever the fuck it was. but it was enjoyable to listen to. And also, for the benefit of anybody listening to this, it's been edited. My internet connection is like one flipping upload Mbps or whatever per second. So you've had a lot of patience with me today. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Cheers, man. We'll see you in a bit.
Yeah, man, nice one. Take care.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You know that thing you've always been too scared to go for? It seems like you'll never have the guts. Then a cancer diagnosis. And doing that thing becomes way less scary. I would know. I've always wanted a black belt. And today, the only thing standing in my way is a few wooden boards. It's been a lot of hard work and 5 years since I beat cancer at Ohio Health. Bring it on. You keep making plans.
Visit ohiohealth.com/keepmakingplans to learn more.